Welcome back. Last time I talked about the processes of colonization and development of agricultural societies along the islands and Greek mainland, the islands of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Greek mainland, through the Neolithic, the Copper Age, and into the Bronze Age. By the end of the third millennium BC, cultural processes in the Bronze Age, approximately 2000 BC, a century or two on either side, depending on the island, cultural processes in the Bronze Age were certainly developing towards greater scales of political centralization and social hierarchy. This was accompanied by a continuing increase in the intensity and reach of regional trading systems. And you'll note that this is a real theme. The necessity of trade, the requirements for trade on these somewhat isolated islands, isolated unless you think about this sophisticated seaborne trading system. None of these islands provided necessarily all of the resources needed for expanded communities, and particularly for their elites. And so what we see, at least in part because of this developing, then is an increase in the density and volume of these trading networks. We shouldn't think about these developments, increases in social hierarchy, increases in political scale, we shouldn't think about them occurring in exactly the same way everywhere in the Eastern Mediterranean. And this is something I emphasized last time. We are here talking about islands particularly. The variability in size, resources, and carrying capacity, remember that term from last time, of the islands, meant that any significant degree of elite control and elite life simply could not be supported in some cases on some of the islands, simply because the carrying capacity, the resource base, was not sufficient to support non-food producers. If you want to think of elites as people who don't grow their own food, then some of the islands are simply too small to support a substantial elite. And these areas retained elements of egalitarian and communal orientations through the Bronze Age and indeed beyond that. The issue was, of course, that they retained these orientations, but at the same time, sometimes they didn't have much choice about being incorporated into expansive political systems. The position of Crete at the center of this vibrant maritime trading system and the agricultural potential of the fertile plains of the island, particularly the plains of central Crete, led to an especially remarkable development of political and cultural life there during the early second millennium BC. On Crete, the period between about 2100 BC and 1450 BC is known as the palatial period. There's that term again. I'm going to be talking now increasingly about palaces. There's some argument about the exact dates on the beginning and on the end of this sequence. These palaces that appear on Crete at approximately the turn of the second millennium BC, approximately 2000 BC, are going to be central to our understandings of political and social systems on the island for much of the next 1,000 years. There's only pretty fragmentary evidence from before this time, from before about 2000 BC, pretty fragmentary evidence of the processes through which these large structures these large architectural structures, and so presumably the functions, the political functions, the economic functions, the social functions, the ceremonial functions that they carried out were developed. We don't have a great deal of data on this. There are some remains actually from underneath the famous Minoan palace at Knossos, seem to be from a very large and earlier structure of the 3rd millennium BC, which would indicate that that area had been an important center for some time. If you remember, I said last time that some of our first evidence for habitation, for settlement, and for farming on Crete comes from Knossos as well. It seems evident that this region and the plains around it were significant over very long periods of time for the population of the island. Also, sites like Thessaloniki in eastern Crete, as I mentioned last time, displays some evidence of large structures from the 3rd millennium BC. We do have enough data to say that the development of palaces and probably Minoan culture more generally was a progressive development in place through time in the 3rd millennium BC. The problem is understanding it. The challenge is twofold. First, the fact that at places like Knossos, successful development of these systems, of these political systems, of these social structures, meant that construction and use continued in later time periods, thus, to some degree, burying and sometimes destroying earlier remains. Another challenge is the degree of destruction in later periods through other processes, natural forces, earthquake, and invasion. And as we're going to see, these are both important in the history of Crete. This also makes archaeological investigations of these earlier time periods very difficult. The best known of the Cretan palaces is certainly this extraordinary palace at Knossos. Really amazing archaeological site. But well-preserved palaces also exist in other areas, at Melia, at Phaistos, and at other sites as well. There's a good deal of controversy among archaeologists about when palace building actually started. But initial construction of most of these sites seems to have taken place between 2100 and 1900 BC. As I said, on a limited number of sites, like Knossos and Thessaloniki, we have evidence of earlier structures. We don't yet understand the level of continuity between those structures of the 3rd millennium BC and those of the palatial period in the early 2nd millennium BC. Since there's some inevitable uncertainty in the interpretation of radiocarbon dates and ceramic chronologies, this period of initial construction, which we generally agree upon exists between 2100 and 1900 BC, may actually even be shorter than that. This may be a faster process than that. These palaces are characterized by open courtyards surrounded by wings of rooms on three or four sides. They were usually made of ashlar, dressed stone masonry, and they frequently featured rows of columns around the peripheries of the courtyards and around entrances. The interpretation of this initial phase of palace building, known as the proto-palatial period, between about 2100 and 1900 BC, is complicated by the fact that there was a general destruction of palaces at about 1750 BC, when new palaces were built in the centuries after that event at 1750 BC, they often further damaged the remains of the earlier structures. As I said, a general archaeological problem on sites that are occupied for a long period. There has also been a great deal of debate about what caused this destruction phase at about 1750 BC. Foreign invasion and warfare have both been suggested, but it seems more likely that an earthquake, relatively common in the region, caused this damage, and it's widespread across Crete. The general continuity of Minoan culture before and after this event would be hard to reconcile with an invasion that could cause that much damage. The palaces built afterwards, after 1750 BC, during the so-called Neopalatial period, are far better known. And indeed, one hazard of doing archaeology on Crete is the assumption that the less well-known Minoan culture of the Proto-Palatial period before 1750 BC is nothing more than an earlier version of Minoan culture after 1750 BC. This kind of assumption that earlier, lesser-known cultural periods were much like later, better-known ones is a common temptation in archaeology. We'll look in much more detail at the role of the palace and the form of Minoan governance in the next lecture. But the distribution of palaces across Crete makes it likely that small autonomous states partitioned the island at this time. In many ways, the biggest challenge in Minoan archaeology of the period lies in figuring out the relationships between the palaces on the one hand and the hierarchy of quite diverse, smaller centers that existed across Minoan Crete on the other hand. Let me turn my attention now to a somewhat different topic, but I think a very interesting one. One very striking characteristic of Minoan archaeology is the profusion of different scripts, different writing systems, known from Minoan period archaeological sites on Crete. And there are at least three different writing systems with relationships that are debated. The first is known as Cretan hieroglyphs. These are not, I will emphasize, the same as Egyptian hieroglyphs. It's just the same word used to describe them. This may be the initial form of writing on the island, and it may be ancestral to the next form of writing, which I'm going to mention, which is called the Linear A script. The third, then, of these forms of writing is the symbols on a very mysterious, enigmatic artifact called the Phaistos disk. So, what can we say about these different forms of writing? Well, it's very challenging in a whole variety of different ways. The first and third of these, Cretan hieroglyphs and the symbols on the Phaistos disk, have never been deciphered. And their cultural associations, their use, and especially the language that they're written in, remain a mystery. There have, in fact, been claims that the Phaistos disk, this small 6-inch wide disk, imprinted with a variety of different relatively enigmatic symbols, is a forgery. Archaeologists and everyone else get worried when we have one unique artifact with a unique form of writing on it, because this is the only universally agreed upon example of this kind of writing. The Phaistos disk was found in a building close to, but not actually in, the Minoan palace at Phaistos on the southern coast of Crete. It's also extremely strange that the symbols on the Phaistos disk are stamped into it. They're not inscribed. It's as if one was looking at an extraordinarily ancient, archaic form of printing press. I mean, this is obviously not the case. They were stamped individually into it. But a writing system that consists of the successive use of stamps for the characters and not inscription or painting is really quite extraordinary. There are some other Cretan artifacts with a few symbols that do to some degree resemble those on the Phaistos disc from other sites on Crete. So it's now more generally accepted that the Phaistos disc is a real archaeological artifact and not a forgery. And it's also more generally accepted that it is actually of Cretan origin, because this was another question. Given the widespread and sophisticated trading network that we see developing around Crete during the Minoan period, given trading contacts and political contacts to Anatolia in Turkey, to the Levant, to the Greek mainland, to Egypt, one of the questions about the Phaistos disc was always whether it was a real artifact or not. If we do accept it as real, and we do accept it as Cretan, then the next question is, what exactly is the relationship of the Phaistos disc to other Minoan writing systems, and possibly to writing systems beyond Crete? Let me move now briefly to the second of these writing systems, Linear A. Linear A uses the same symbols as a later, very archaic form of Greek, written in Crete and the Greek mainland during the later Mycenaean period and called Linear B. So here we have in total, it's a little difficult to keep straight. We have Cretan hieroglyphics, we have the Phaistos disc, we have Linear A, and we have Linear B. It's possible that Cretan hieroglyphics are ancestral to Linear B. The Phaistos disc sort of sits out there and nobody knows quite what to make of it. And Linear A is, in turn, probably, at least as a writing system, ancestral to Linear B. However, if the sounds associated with particular symbols in Linear B, which we know is a form of Greek, are applied to Linear A texts, the resulting sound patterns do not seem to be closely related to any known language. They are regular. They appear to be a language, but again, a linguistic isolate. This finding and this diversity, this extraordinary diversity of writing systems on Minoan Crete may indicate some significant degree of linguistic and cultural diversity on the island during the Minoan period as well. We can't necessarily assume that Crete was occupied during the Minoan period by one single ethnic group speaking one single language with one single culture. To put this in a larger context, through the latter part of the 3rd millennium BC, there was a general diffusion of Mesopotamian cuneiform beyond Mesopotamia. If you remember, Mesopotamian cuneiform developed the end of the Uruk period, the end of the 4th millennium BC in Mesopotamia, and through the 3rd millennium BC diversified, its uses diversified within Mesopotamia, but it also began to be used beyond that region as this system of writing, and more generally as the idea of writing, was adopted and modified by different groups of people to their own needs. Thus, for example, the Hittite state in Anatolia in Turkey adopted cuneiform to be used with the Hittite language. But there was also, through this period, a series of inventions of other scripts throughout the Near East, and these may well have been inspired by cuneiform. Many of these are very little known, and one thing I will note that's really interesting is the inspiration seems to have been from cuneiform. It seems to have been from Mesopotamia. We really don't see the same process of by which Egyptian hieroglyphics inspire writing systems. This seems to be coming primarily from cuneiform. So we may be seeing similar processes taking place on Crete, which certainly had plenty of chance for contacts with areas of the Levant, with Anatolia, and other areas throughout the Near East, where these processes of both the adoption of cuneiform and use of cuneiform, and also the invention of other forms of writing, were taking place. Minoan culture seems to have been very influential beyond Crete as well. On the islands of the Greek Cyclades, northwest of Crete, and on the Dodecanese, northeast of Crete, between 2000 BC and about 1600 BC. Probably because these islands were being incorporated into a larger Eastern Mediterranean trading sphere dominated by the Minoans. And so we can imagine under these circumstances the great influence not merely of the Minoan trading system, but also of Minoan culture. There are at least two likely Minoan colonies in the area at this time, where it seems that there were actually populations from Crete settling in other parts of the Eastern Mediterranean. At Castri on Kythera, an island off the southern tip of the Greek mainland, and at Trianda on Rhodes off the Turkish coast. It's not clear whether settlements like Akrotiri on the island of Thera, Santorini, approximately 110 kilometers or 70 miles north of Crete, which was destroyed by a volcanic eruption in the middle of the second millennium BC, it's not clear whether the colony at Akrotiri was really a colony or simply a community that was very heavily influenced by Minoan culture. This maritime trading system seems to have been extensive and efficient. Besides the Greek islands and Rhodes, there's a good deal of evidence for Minoan trade to Cyprus, to Egypt, probably southern Anatolia, certainly the Levant during this period. One of the things that archaeologists would like to know more about is actually the activities of Minoan traders further to the west, along the coast of Italy, Sicily, and into the western Mediterranean, where we have fragmentary evidence for Minoan contact. Our general impression of Minoans and of Minoan society is as a very outward-looking society and culture, very much involved in regional economies and politics. It's sometimes been referred to by a pretty imprecise term as a thalassocracy, a maritime civilization. What exactly that's meant to mean in political or social terms is often pretty unclear. But this maritime orientation and the success of this maritime orientation is pretty inarguable. There's a great deal of debate about how Minoan culture identified the influence of Mycenaean states on the Greek mainland. Those Mycenaean states developed out of the Middle Helladic culture, which I referred to in my last lecture, and they begin to demonstrate significant levels of social hierarchy and political centralization in the middle of the second millennium BC. Mycenaean culture looks significantly different from that of the Minoans in a number of different respects. Although it's arguable that the same dynamic of population growth and elite competition was at work in both areas during the Bronze Age. This does seem to be the case. In the Mycenaean case, on the Greek mainland, there's not so much evidence for agricultural intensification, although trading systems do seem to have been well developed. We find Mycenaean artifacts, like those of Minoans, and particularly ceramics and bronze artifacts, in various areas around the Eastern Mediterranean and even as far away as Central Europe. Palaces are found in both Minoan and Mycenaean political centers, with some limited evidence of Minoan architectural influence on the Mycenaean cases. However, Mycenaean palaces are far more focused on the throne room than are their Minoan equivalents. And we're going to look at this a little bit further next time. And the Mycenaean political centers are often heavily fortified, as are other settlements beyond those political centers. And it's interesting and potentially significant that for the most part, Minoan settlements on Crete are not fortified. Later Linear B texts give us a limited amount of information on the organization of Mycenaean society and the Mycenaean state. As I mentioned before, these Linear B texts are in an archaic form of Greek. That historical information, along with archaeological data, show that Mycenaean Greece over the period between about 1650 and 1100 BC was a constellation of small independent states based at centers like Mycenae, Tiryns, Pylos, Thebes, and Athens, among others. Each of these centers was ruled by a king who maintained a set of noble retainers, and each had a relatively simple, very simple, administrative bureaucracy that controlled the court, the capital, and the territory. The complex and often difficult topography of the Greek mainland makes it hard to directly compare the territories that these different centers controlled, but we should think of them as small territorial states, each probably capable of exerting some degree of control over regions perhaps 50 to 100 kilometers or 30 to 60 miles away from the state center. Despite the small size of these territories, I would not call these city-states on the Mesopotamian analogy. Even though their territories may be comparable in size to the Mesopotamian cases, these political centers could hardly be called urban. They were probably occupied by a few thousand people at maximum. Mycenaean Greek cultural values seem to have focused significantly upon the exploits of noble warriors and warfare between and beyond these Mycenaean states seem to have been common. The degree to which those famous texts by Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, actually refer to these Mycenaean cases is a matter of perennial archaeological debate. And as we shall see next time, this warrior focus of Mycenaean political and social systems appears to provide a distinct contrast with that of Minoan Crete. Thank you very much.